Bring the meeting to order, the Public Safety, Crime Prevention, Policy, and Finance. And Mr. Sparby, would you take the role?
I didn't.
Chairman Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard?
Here.
Representative Mullery?
Here.
Representative Doubt?
Here.
Representative Gauthier?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen?
Here.
Representative Hilty?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Kelly?
Here.
Representative Kiefer? Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Leidiger?
Here.
Representative Mariani? Representative McDonald?
Here.
Representative Moran? Representative Nornes?
Here.
Representative Slocum?
Here.
Representative Smith?
Here.
Okay. Quorum being present, Representative Hilty, would you like to move the minutes of March 14th?
I would, Mr. Chair. I actually had an opportunity to read them this morning.
Okay.
But did you read them?
I had a premonition.
He had the opportunity.
He had the opportunity. Say he read them.
Representative Hilty moves the minutes of March 14th. Any corrections, additions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Members and viewers here, we're going to change the order around just a little bit and put Representative Champion and number, what is it, four? How many bills we got? Four? And then move Kreese up to, Representative Kreisel up to three. Twofold purpose would be if we can get the students back to school and learning and after their expert testimony, and then Representative Champion, the success of your bill will depend on the short-windedness of your colleagues here. That's strategy. No, until we get to the end at noon abruptly, so we've got other commitments. So
we should go on and on.
But these are all consent calendar bills anyway.
We should go on and on with Champion then.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. The first one would be Representative McDonald.
Correct.
And House File 2789.
Okay.
Representative McDonald, would you like to move your bill and
no amendments?
Okay. Where are we sending it?
General Register.
You'd like to make the motion to move your bill?
Yes, I do. I'd like to make a motion to pass House File 2789 and move it to Judiciary? No. Move it to the House
General
Register.
Okay. Representative McDonald moves his bill recommended to pass and move to the General Register. And Representative McDonald, go ahead in any way you wish to proceed.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill was brought to my attention by the attorneys after a decision in Rice County court case where a judge ruled that the scale used to weigh methamphetamines did not meet the statutory drug definition of drug paraphernalia, even though the scale had drug residue on it. The judge even indicated that the scale fits in the common definition of paraphernalia. This remedy is not for this just one incident. It is not isolated. The distribution, sale, and use of meth continues to be a very big problem in our state and in my county. You may have read the story just last Saturday in the Star and Tribune's paper that charges being filed in Hennepin County on a major meth operation. We need to ensure that the prosecutors have the ability to fully prosecute meth crimes and are able to use the evidence and the tools that people use to make, package, and sell this drug. At this time, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Mr. Benjamin Bayar. He is the assistant Rice County attorney, and he will answer some questions and go into a little bit further detail containing this bill.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you state your name and title and begin, sir.
My name is Benjamin Bihar. I'm an assistant county attorney with the Rice County Attorney's Office. Thank you for the committee's time to allow me to testify today.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Thank you. The proposed amendments to this the statutory definitions are primarily technical amendments to help clarify that drug and methamphetamine paraphernalia includes materials that are also used in packaging, selling, and buying controlled substances. I echo Representative McDonald's comments that this is not just for this one case. The Rice County District Court's decision is going to have an impact on future prosecutions if scales that have methamphetamine residue cannot be within the statutory definition of methamphetamine paraphernalia. After all, should a child or a vulnerable adult get a hold of a scale with methamphetamine residue and ingest that somehow, the same harm would come to that child as if the child had a pipe that is used to ingest methamphetamine. I know that the committee's time is short, and I'll be available for any questions that the committee may have.
Hey, members, any questions for the testifier? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Behar, or Representative McDonald, I'm just curious about the word buying in this context. How do you use equipment or paraphernalia in buying a controlled substance?
Well, I believe oftentimes a buyer... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I believe oftentimes a buyer will bring a scale to the buy to make sure that the methamphetamine that is being purchased, it weighs up and is the right amount so that they're not getting ripped off and whatnot. So scales are often used, but it's not just scales. It could be what's known as scoop straws, which are used to take methamphetamine out of a larger package and put it into a smaller package to facilitate the transaction. So it would not just be limited to scales. There's also scoop straws and other things like that that are used in the sale and exchange.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you just explain how this fits into whatever? Does it affect forfeitures? Does it affect just prosecution? If so, what does this do? I mean, we've got just this little bill, but I don't think most of us know the whole chapter or whatever. Just briefly.
Mr. Behar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This primarily just clarifies the fact that the methamphetamine paraphernalia is not just those materials that are used in the manufacturing and ingesting of methamphetamine. Paraphernalia also is very commonly used, and it's critical for prosecution to be able to show that it also is paraphernalia that's used in packaging, selling, and buying methamphetamine. And again, should a child get a hold of that paraphernalia, like the scale with residue that was in the Rice County case, the harm that would come to that child from ingesting or being exposed to that methamphetamine is the same harm that would come as if the child had a pipe, a methamphetamine pipe, and licked it or something like that. So it's really a clarification based on the district court's interpretation that the scale is not included technically within the definition of methamphetamine paraphernalia as it currently is.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
So what this is doing is you can prosecute for having this particular paraphernalia, and there's a specific statute someplace in the book with penalties and things on that. That's what you're saying?
Mr. Behar.
That is correct.
Okay.
And it's 152.137.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none. I have none. Representative McDonald, do we need closing remarks in your motion?
No, I appreciate your support. I hope you support this. It's another tool that is necessary to solve and help rid our state of this drug that is ruining lives. And I encourage you to support for House File 2789, and we'll move it to the General Register. And good morning, and thank you.
Okay. Representative McDonald moves his bill recommended to pass and go to the General Register. No questions. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman. And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That's a great tie you have on today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee members.
Is the eye somewhere? What is it?
Well, why are we wearing the
Whoa.
welcome to the committee, Mr. Chair, and just a...
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move House File 2860 to be recommended to pass and move to Ways and Means.
Representative Cornish moves House File 2860, recommend for passage and sent to Ways and Means. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, a short introduction here. You folks, I think we were all here then. We had a presentation on the fire safety account and money that comes from the insurance policy deduction for fire safety and goes into an account and is administered by DPS. We had a quite long presentation about it. The firemen were in and showed you all the good things they can do with the training. What we would like to do is take the money in the account and distribute it out now, and we need the authority to do that so that we can do it now instead of later. And I would like to bring my testifier, the first one, whichever one wants to come up.
Thank you, and please state your name for the record for us, please.
Members of the committee, Niall Zickman, Fire Chief at Spring Lake Park, Blaine Monsey Fire Department, but here representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs, the Minnesota State Fire Department Association, the local Fire Marshals Group, and the local Fire Ambassadors Group, as we formed a coalition. I would like to begin by thanking the committee chair for being the chief author of this bill and for scheduling time in the hearing to hear this important issue for us. As he said, most of you are familiar with the fire safety account. As again, last year we had a significant amount of committee time to go over that. With me today, after I conclude, is the commander of Task Force 1, the Special Rescue Team, Yuli Seal, and he's going to talk briefly about what that unit does. You should have been distributed to you a plan that has been developed over the last 6 months by all of the fire service groups in the state of Minnesota. The best way to describe that would probably be our business plan. The highlights of that plan include it has the unanimous support of all the fire service groups in the state of Minnesota. It identifies $39.5 million worth of needs in firefighter training, the regional response teams, and the state fire marshal's office, which supports all the fire departments in the state. We prioritize our needs. We establish measurable outcomes for all of those needs and benchmarks. And there's some documentation in there that talks about and details how efficient the fire service is in Minnesota. The Minnesota Taxpayers Association has for decades tracked the cost of different services, and Minnesota continues to rank 45th to 47th. And that's a combination of how efficient we are because of the volunteers, but even on our career side, we see departments like Minneapolis and St. Paul operating with half the firefighters of departments in cities of other states. And the point of all that is we're a pretty efficient service, and every dollar that we put into that system is returned back to the taxpayers. Specific to House File 2860 and Chair Cornish's request to appropriate that $4.5 million, we detail in the plan generally how that money would be spent. It's the recommendation coming from the fire service. The process is it goes to an advisory committee that advises the Commissioner of Public Safety, who has final authority and reports back to you on how that money is spent. We have identified some additional needs in the Fire Marshal's Office to support those local fire departments, mostly in the code area and in the fire investigation area. Most departments, the vast majority, don't have resources. It's just the metro departments that have resources to do code enforcement, and we're under the process right now of getting a new fire code. We've not had a fire code since 2006 is the current edition we're using. And so that adoption is going on as we speak. There'll be many changes, need for a lot of training, need for a lot of support. And then similar on fire investigation, it's a big state. There's very few state investigators and they allow on those locals. And so the plan is to use those monies to help train locals. Task Force 1, which Chief Seal will talk about, our hazardous material teams. There's 11 of those teams. They're state teams. They've not had an increase since they were initiated back in the early 90s. We have one emergency response team, that is St. Paul. They are close to the point of needing to turn that team back in if they don't get additional funding. And so We're appropriating or looking to appropriate $100,000 of them and $20,000 to the other teams to just help offset those administrative costs. My department hosts one of those teams. My assistant chief spends a quarter of his time, so about 500 hours a year, running and administering that team. We get $2,000 a year to reimburse his 500 hours, and I do pay him more than $8,000 a year. So it's not quite enough there. And then the biggest one is the firefighter training. And if I could direct you now to your plan in page 17 and 18, it's an example of the benchmarks. Minnesota has a voluntary fire certification program. Certification tests by a third party, independent agency to national standards. When you pass these tests, they're written and their practicals, you go into a national database, and they're good across the nation. And they just illustrate the training need. If you look at the top chart, there's 21,340 firefighters in the state. It blows about 2,000 our career. But you see the number of people that are trained to Firefighter 2, just under 5,000. If you've got Firefighter 2, you've got Firefighter 1. It's progressive. When you add those two together, not even half the firefighters in the state are trained to the minimum firefighter level, and it's a function of money. Going through those charts, you see the number of fire officers, it's less than 2%. These are the men and women that are controlling the crews, managing those crews, going into those hazard situations, and less than 2% of them have been certified. At the bottom of the page, those are our chemical response teams. Those are the people that are on those teams. There's over 400. They should all be at the hazmat technician level, 67R. And again, it's a function of money. It's a function of training costs. It's not the certification cost. That's $225 for the hazmat test. But there's thousands of dollars invested in getting those individuals. And then as you flip the page, you just see some more of those disciplines as we go up and down. Task Force 1 is at the top. Chief C will talk about that. You see the fire motor operator. That's the driver. Again, we think there should be thousands of folks at that fire apparatus operator level, and we've got 824. And so with that, I'd like to conclude my testimony, and with the chair's permission and the committee's permission to have Chief Seal come up and talk a little bit about Task Force 1. I don't know that we've ever spent a lot of time sharing with you what that unit does.
Thank you. Chief Seal?
Mr. Chair, while Representative Cornish. It should make it clear, I think, Murph. Financial person, Mr. Walsh, will back this up, that this doesn't require to raise the revenue that's already sitting there in the account. It's just an appropriation of money that's already there. So it's been sitting there for, what, now a year at least? Four and a half million. This is the one account that we took out to help balance the general fund, but we left about half of it in. Is that right,
Mr. Walsh?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Chief, go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Yuli Seal. I'm the fire chief from the city of Bloomington, and I'm also here representing Minnesota Task Force 1. Minnesota Task Force 1 is comprised of 180 individuals, highly trained individuals, from five primary agencies and seven participating agencies. And these individuals are trained in how to rescue people from collapsed structures, from trenches, from confined spaces, from high-angled or entrapment environments that could occur. We've had a number of responses in the state already. We've been in existence since about 2005 as a result of a study we did in the state looking for gaps in response capabilities in 2002, 2003. So we began putting this team together in 2004 and basically stood it up in 2005 with the training of the initial class. We're now roughly 180 strong, and all of the participating agencies and the primary agencies have a significant stake in this team, in that most of their personnel's time and effort towards providing the service to the state is been on those agencies' dime. Most of the equipment we've acquired, or all of the equipment we have acquired, has been done so through grants. So at this point in time, we're looking for support so we can provide this funding to continue training in those skills, continue maintaining our equipment, and continue maintaining the team to provide emergency response in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Chief. Are there any other testifiers? Mr. Danaski? And please state your name for the record.
Mr. Vice Chair, members, good morning. My name is Mark Danaski. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. I'll be very brief. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2860. Over the past several months, the Commissioner's Office has worked closely with the Fire Service Advisory Committee and a number of the other fire service boards around the state to help define the needs of Minnesota's fire services. The Department of Public Safety supports the bill's appropriation from the Fire Safety Account. Further, the appropriation is also identified and supported in the Governor's Supplemental Budget Plan. The Commissioner's Office will continue to work with the Fire Service Advisory Committee for the effective expenditure of these funds as directed through Minnesota Statute 299F. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Danaski. Any other testifiers, members of the public?
I think that concludes the testimony.
Okay. Seeing no one racing to the chair. Any questions for members?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Two or three questions of the author, Representative Cornish. I'm looking at the strategic expenditure plan. First of all, question one, when we appropriate the $4.5 million for purposes of the two bienniums listed in the plan, does that leave any funds remaining in the fire safety account?
Representative Cornish, you want me to?
I could have Mr. Walsh answer that. I think it'll be replenished in the new biennium, but Mr. Walsh, could you answer that?
How much is left after we do the $4.5 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I believe the group was initially seeking $4.5 million in perpetuity. I don't know how much would be left at the end of this year with this appropriation. I just know that there was an amount sufficient to fund $4.5 million in perpetuity. With this $4.5 million taken out, I'm not exactly sure what the balance would be. Currently, though, there are collections in excess of current expenditures.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith, Mr. Danaski may, I see he's approached the bench here. Maybe he's got something to add.
Yeah, I do need some clarification on that, Mr. Chairman, because the book that's dated this month indicates that there's $21.5 million left in the fund. How much is left after we appropriate $4.5 million?
Mr. Danaski.
Mr. Vice Chair, members, the fire safety account, as Representative Cornish mentioned, is drawn from a percentage of insurance premiums that are paid to the state. So the count on an annual basis, actually semi-annual, is collecting that funding. The $4.5 million, as I understand in this bill, is a one-time appropriation for this 1 year. The group will have to come back again in a subsequent session next year for the ongoing appropriations of that $4.5 million. There is an excess in the account now because it wasn't expended last year. But the total amount that will be expended over the course of this particular fiscal year will include the amount that's carried over, plus the additional revenues that will be brought in over the course of the next year.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, that was a non-responsive answer. How much in dollars is left in the account when this bill passes?
Mr. Danaski?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Waltz is going to take a second chance at this, so he's coming to the rescue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I have the spreadsheet up in my office. I can just run up and get it, but I believe it's a couple $100,000 at the end of the year and then sufficient to make additional appropriations if the legislature so chose in future years.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think the committee should see that. Again, the March 12th this month, strategic expenditure plan references leaving $21.5 million. So I guess the ultimate question is, why just appropriate? I would imagine we're appropriating or trying to the $4.5 million to prevent the governor and the legislature from stealing from this special account fund down the road. So, Representative Cornish, if that's the case, why not appropriate all?
Well, the first answer is that's all they asked for. Now let Niles take that.
Mr. Barry, Vice Chair, Representative Smith, and let me also thank you. For those that don't know, Representative Smith was the original author of the fire safety account. The $4.5 million was a strategic decision on the fire service part. It was the remainder that was left over last year as we were advocating for the money. Since that time, additional money has come in. I think it's right like 5.1 million, so there's 600,000, but then there's also the next year's collection, which is, I got a spreadsheet last week of about 12 million, but that has to stay there because you got general fund coming on it, you got state fire marshal coming on it. So really it's that, I think the answer is directly, there's I think 5.1 and we're asking for 4.5 because that's what we asked for last year and we want to stay true to our word.
Mr. Chairman, just one last comment. I'm not asking this question to embarrass or be rude to anybody because I support this bill completely. I just don't believe stealing from special revenue funds by this legislature is any way to balance a budget, and especially this one, because it's meant to train and keep trained firefighters so that when our house burns down, we can get saved from it. So thank you for your bill, Representative Cornish.
Any other questions from Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could someone, the author, or someone, maybe Mr. Walls, clarify for me, does any expenditure from this fund have to be a legislative appropriation, or what does it, how do funds flow?
Representative Cornish,
out of this account?
Well, it comes from the assurance, and then it ends up to advisory board. It finally channels way down through quite a bit of accountability and grant request from the fire department.
Mr. Zuckman, go ahead.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Hilty. The money does have to be appropriated. It goes into a special revenue account, and it sits there until you appropriate it from the special revenue account into the fire safety account, and then it goes to the process that the chair mentioned. There's an advisory committee that makes a recommendation to the commissioner. The commissioner has the final say. Eventually, that gets reported back to this committee. But you need to appropriate it.
Mr. Zuckman, then what is the status of the fire safety account at the moment, other than this proposed $4.5 million boost?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Hilty, I think DPS Fiscal Finance could give you the exact detail, but all those monies that have been allocated are in the process of being spent. Fire Marshal is spending their budget. Homeland Security has sent the money out to the CAT chemical assessment teams. Task Force 1 has really not received any money, so they're not busy spending any. And the Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education is in the middle of the round 5 of disbursements. Departments are training, spending the dollars, and sending in reimbursement dollars. I just sent a reimbursement request in yesterday. They get reimbursement requests every day at the Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education. So the system is working, I think, if that's your question. And so the money's constantly flowing to tell you the exact number. I don't know that you could do that.
The bottom line, I think, Mr.
Representative Cornish,
the fund is very healthy, and there's enough money in there. The problem is that the legislature has been draining it to balance the budget, and that's what we are trying to fix here by appropriating it like it should be.
Any additional questions from members? No, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, did I hear you say there was $39 million in training needs? Did I hear you say that?
Mr. Zuckman?
Mr. Chairman, the plan identifies $39.5 million of total needs. The training needs, I didn't bring my plan up with me, I think are about 20-some million of that, and that is to address the firefighter 1 and 2, the fire officer and the operator, and then the specialty teams. And that would be across the next 3 years. And that is the cost of tuitions, books, and certification. It does not encompass any of the payroll costs, which would be borne by the individual or employer.
So looking at, thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this spreadsheet and looking at your needs of $39 million, and we're projecting $13 million each year, it's amazing it balances out. I just want to echo Representative Smith's position. I just think it's bad public policy to tax the taxpayers of Minnesota, telling them that we're going to provide funding for fire training and interventions, and then stealing it to balance the budget. I know we have a hazmat team up in Duluth, and they do the best they can do, but there's all kinds of unmet needs throughout this state. And when I have a firefighter show up at my neighbor's or my house, I want to make sure they're well trained and doing what they need to do to save life and property. So I would just support Representative Smith's position on that.
Representative Cornish, I don't see any other questions. You want to renew your motion?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that working together with the DFL, we'd like to fix the problem because both parties, when they've been in the majority, have done the exact same thing, taken about the same amount of money, so we're both guilty of it. And this is a way of working together to fix that for the future. So we are dedicated to council to where they're dedicated. So, and with that, I would like to renew my motion of House File 2860 be recommended pass and moved to Ways and Means.
President Cornish renews the motion to House File 2860 be recommended for passage and moved to House Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee members. Appreciate it.
Motion is passed. We also, as the chair makes his way back to the chair, we have the 12th grade students from Minnesota Transition School in Minneapolis here with us today. So welcome.
Representative Kreisel, are you ready to present your bill?
I am.
Representative Kreisel, you go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 1838 pass. I'm not sure where it's going. To the General Register.
Okay, Representative Kreisel moves 1838. We recommend it to pass and move to the General Register. Representative Kreisel, go ahead and however you wish to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. What House File 1838 would do is exempt DWI from our get-out-of-jail-free card. It's something that I believe is wrong, that we would be above any law. I understand the originality, the reasons why we did it in the first place or why it was in there, but I think it sends a wrong message to our constituents, to the people of the state of Minnesota, that we have the ability to make laws down here, but some of them we are exempted from arrest. I have students here that brought the bill to me. This was their idea. I think it's a great idea, and it's awesome to see people involved in the legislative process like they've been. I will let them testify and take it from here, Mr. Chair.
Okay, whoever would like to start, to go ahead and give your name, and why don't you give your name and what school and class you're in.
Good morning. My name is Corey Smith. I'm a sophomore majoring in political science at Concordia University, St. Paul. And on behalf of my fellow students, professors, and citizens across Minnesota, I thank you, Chairman Cornish, and Representative Kreisel, and Senator Perry for being our chief authors along with our co-authors, Chairman Davids, Representative Winkler, Senators Nino, Vandadeer, and Harrington. Today we respect your time. We will be quick, concise, yet informative. We will tell you about our support for House File 1838, which we call No Boozing and Cruising in Minnesota, in three steps. Step one, the why. Step two, the how, and step three, the why and why not.
Yes, sir, go through your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nate Thines. I'm a junior at Concordia St. Paul. I'm in the Criminal Justice and Political Science program. We want to be clear. We know the Minnesota Constitution and other states have the same language of treason, felony, and breach of peace. Back in the early 1800s, it was meant to make sure, for political reasons, that a legislator was not in jail or in prison, therefore not able to go to an important vote during a legislative session. But times have changed since the early 1800s, and that is why we're here today. We have spent hours and months researching this issue. Each year, numerous lives are lost due to careless driving and irrational driving. In 2010, 82 Minnesotans were arrested for impaired driving a day. One out of every 8 Minnesotans currently has a DUI. We are for public safety first, but we cannot ignore fairness, Trust me, we all know someone's life has been affected by DUI arrests and consequences. They are expensive, they screw up employment opportunities, and can even break up families. Also, many of us may know people that have been affected by a drunk driver hitting them or them just affecting themselves. And there, last year there were 131 deaths due to drunk driving related crashes, and the cost of injuries and accidents was $275 million. And we just want to cut that cost down.
Thank you. Ma'am, if you could state your name and go ahead.
My name is Taylor Gittins. I am in the psychology program and a senior at Concordia University. We just want to reinforce that our bill is not a constitutional amendment. We are only expanding the definition of breach of peace to include impaired driving in statute to only apply to purposes of the Constitution. So in a simple nutshell, we are removing any temptation to use legislator immunity for drinking and driving as a legislator. We are not by any means changing legislator immunity. We've done our homework and realized that legislator immunity is grounded in both the state and federal constitutions. Our founding fathers, just freed from English tyranny, wanted to ensure that elected representatives would not face arbitrary arrest for the sake of political retribution. The reason for the privilege is clear. It was well summarized by James Wilson, an influential member of the Committee of Detail, which was responsible for the provision in the federal constitution. In order to enable and encourage a representative of the public to discharge his public trust with firmness and success, it is indispensably necessary that he should enjoy the fullest liberty of speech, and that he should be protected from the resentment of everyone, however powerful, to whom the exercise of that liberty may occasion offense. Peter Watson, Senate counsel, did a briefing on legislator immunity in 1997, and court cases deal with legislator immunity and defining legislator activities. This memo was silent on any cases related to impaired driving. We've researched and found approximately 7 to 8 other states that have changed their definitions after similar circumstances, the most recent being Arizona and Colorado. Arizona was because of a domestic abuse arrest, and Colorado was because of a DWI.
Okay, Representative Creasel, if that's your testimony, we want to take questions at this time. Any questions from members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the author or any of the testifiers, just curious if there is, has there been a case in Minnesota that a senator or a state representative was stopped for DWI and that was not detained and allowed to continue because he was in session?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm not sure. I think we all would have heard about it. I haven't been around here long enough to know for sure, but.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative McDonald.
Just to follow up, it's a good bill, of course, I support it, and it certainly makes good sense. But I think it's important to note for the general public and those who may be viewing this in future that there was no incident that brought this to the House, of course, to the SOB. So I think it's important just to note that that there was no incident, and it's not a cause and effect kind of bill. So I think it's important for the public to know that. If that made any sense at all, sometimes I don't make sense, especially with the camera shoved in my face. Got to hear? That's not funny.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, any legislator that wears a brilliant green tie, as my esteemed colleague does to the House, nearing St. Patrick's Day in St. Paul always makes sense. So, well done. I have a couple questions. One technical question for the author, Representative Creasel. I just want to make really clear, Article 4, Section 10 of the Constitution obviously, you know, deals with this issue on point, but the remainder of the paragraph in that section says, for any speech or debate in either house, they should not be questioned in any other place. Is there anything about your bill that would impede on that recognized privilege for members?
Representative Creasel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, not that I am aware of. It certainly is not my intent to affect that part.
And Mr. Chair, perhaps counsel can help us with this. I think you're right because of the constitutes the breach of peace part, but I want to make very clear that we're not
doing something unattended here.
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, it's my understanding that the way it's drafted is very narrow and tied to the definition of breach of peace, and the clause that you referenced that I omitted from my bill summary, I left that out intentionally because I didn't want to confuse the two separate issues and have them tied together. But now that you brought it up, to clarify that the intent of the drafting was to not address that specific immunity within Section 10.
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct, but I want us to be very careful. I mean, we've got two issues here. Obviously, the ability of the representatives of the people to be able to speak and debate with fully the different opinions of the public is something that we always want to be careful about. I have a question for the students, and first of all, thank you for the work that you've done on this. Terrific work. It sounds like you did some really good research and some creative thinking. It's obviously pretty difficult. There isn't anyone here who supports, the behavior around DWI or DUI. In fact, we passed those laws and strengthened those laws over the years. My question, as long as you're students and you're studying this issue, I mean, it seems to me there are a balance of interests the Constitution is trying to pay attention to, and I don't think that the intent, I would argue the intent, wasn't to create a privilege over and apart the citizenry to promote any sense of irresponsibility on the part of elected officials. However, in a democracy, you have to have elected officials free from arbitrary a prosecution that, in fact, would inhibit the voice of the people to be expressed. And so I'm wondering if you've given some thought to what would lead you to believe that we would not, in Minnesota, ever see arbitrary arrests by evoking this change in statute that could inhibit the rights of the people to be heard here in the legislature. Is there something that you're feeling confident about, in terms of our state, that 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, we would never see arbitrary behavior on the part of law enforcement officials to prohibit Representative Creasel from participating in our democracy? And the reason I ask is because this is kind of a common trick that's done in other so-called democracies around the world, where people are elected, and then you have a powerful executive branch, and that's what we're talking about. The executive, ultimately, executive branch of government is the deliverer of law enforcement activities. And so we see in other countries where, in fact, they use the law to prevent a Representative Creasel, you can have trumped up charges, those kind of things. I'm just curious, quickly, if you guys have thought about that issue. How do you feel about the balance that's necessary here? Do you understand the importance of balance? And do you feel confident that we would never go down that road here in Minnesota?
Representative Creasel, or anybody with them?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We understand that it is necessary for people to be pillaged from arrest. We just feel that in the case of drunk driving, it's very irresponsible, and with what you stated, and with all the laws that you guys have previously made to make the DUIs tougher in Minnesota, that we do not we would not want anybody taking abusing that privilege, and if someone is impaired, we wouldn't want them necessarily voting on a certain bill for that reason. Also, I mean, we understand, we don't think we're going down the road where that all the privilege will be taken away. We just want to make it stricter for the DUI enforcement purpose, because we've increased patrols and the laws lately, and we just want to take the next step and make it so that everybody sees that, well, you guys can't do it either, we can't do it, no one, it's not going to be accepted anywhere in Minnesota.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, there are times when we're impaired, we make decisions that has more to do with living off of junk food and staying awake for 24 hours at a time. So,
listening to McDonald's.
Or listening to Representative Gautier, for that matter.
Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think I'll
accept it as a friendly amendment. You're suggesting that this only applies to Democrats. However, I see some real problems with this. First of all, as somebody who's looked at issues on driving, some people with over an 08 are not near as dangerous as people that have been here for 30, 40 hours without sleep. I don't think narrowing in on something that's not as dangerous is another thing that we do here. But the biggest issue I see is allowing an arrest and processing of that arrest and how that interferes with the people in the district of the legislator. They have a right to have that legislator voting here. And if somebody is arrested, especially if there's not a, if it's on suspicion, there's not a actual test, keeping there for processing, and 40,000 people are not being represented here because of that. I see no problem with why can't they be taken, why can't the evidence be taken, and the booking, all that kind of stuff that goes along with an arrest, happen later when it's not going to interfere with somebody's representing their people here.
Representative Creasel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I understand that point, but I would argue that any representative that knowingly goes out, consumes enough alcohol to become impaired, and then gets behind a wheel of a motor vehicle, which itself is very dangerous to the general public, it's more than just an issue of are they fit to vote or the people of their district getting that voice. It's someone who made a decision. I would consider that derelicting of duty, that they're going out there. It's their job to represent the people, but they're making the choice on their own to go out and do that, consume that alcohol, and put the general public at risk. And I think it is important that they would be held just like any other citizen of the state would be, and put through the same process. And if there's, I would assume that there would be repercussions, and I think that would be right. If I went out and got a DWI and missed votes, and people in my district felt that they didn't get their voice heard because of that, then I would expect to face some consequences in the next election, and I would deserve those consequences.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Creasel, that doesn't even address the issue I'm saying, which is you are taking away the vote of 40,000 people, and I don't know that you should have that right. The issue of whether to prosecute them or do other things, arrest them later for the act, is a little different issue. And you haven't provided, you know, and I don't know if there's some other way to do it that you want to require whoever the law enforcement is to drive them here or something like that. But I think that if, as it is, I think this creates a huge problem that is not acceptable, to taking away the vote of 40,000 people. If you, there may be another way around it, but right now I think that that's not acceptable.
The you raised a point, but I think that there was a list of offenses that you can be arrested for, and this is just adding one more to that list. So it's not like nobody can be arrested right now. There are a number of people that can, felonies and this and that, but this has been just adding that to the list that could be arrested. So, and right. I wouldn't think you do too good job up here voting drunk. So. Maybe better than some.
Maybe somebody.
Representative. Did you want to make a comment?
Briefly, yeah. Representative Mariani had brought up the point of just arresting somebody to make sure that they're not there to vote. I think with DUI, if there's proof that they are intoxicated, they committed a crime, that's where I feel comfortable with them being put in jail that night. You know, back in the 1800s, maybe there was situations, and like Representative Mariani pointed out, in other democracies, there are ways where they will just throw them in jail for whatever reason, making sure they don't get that vote. I feel very comfortable with this language because they committed a crime. This isn't just to keep them off the House floor to make that vote. So that's where I'm coming from on the
a very low number. If it's a fourth-degree DWI, law enforcement would better answer this, but there's a lot of counties that let them go on their RPR that night. Unless they're wasted, they put them in detox, or if it's some more serious crime. Some of the counties, I think, keep them until they're sober, but I know down in Blue Earth County, they let them go to a responsible party. So they probably get back to session in time to vote. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kreisel, and I didn't get all your names, but I'm encouraged to see young people involved in the process, and thanks for taking interest in this. I guess I understand some of the concerns that have been raised, but I think adding this to the list of things that you can be arrested for is a good idea. I personally think that when you run for public office, you're called to a higher standard of behavior than just an average citizen, because you're an example to the people that you're elected from by, and also to the students. I personally don't drink at all, okay? And of course, I don't have much fun in life either. But
not that right.
No. That must have tickled somebody over there. But anyway. No, I do, you know, this is something I learned late in life, and I'll just share it here, is because we have a lot of young people in the office. There's a difference between fun and joy in life, okay? Fun is short-term and is gone the next day and can have long-term negative consequences. You can go gambling for a day. That can be fun, but it can have negative consequences. Just hear me out. You can do other negative things that are fun, use of illegal drugs, that are fun for a day but can have long-term negative consequences. Joy, on the other hand, comes from doing the right thing over a long period of time, whether it feels good or not. Okay? Joy is a commitment to your children over a long period of time and trying to promote what's best for them. Joy is being committed to your spouse in a marriage and staying with them even when things are difficult. That produces joy. Fun is just a short-term zing that goes away. So just a little advice, and I support the bill.
Representative Grunhagen brings me much joy.
Got his vote. All right. Representatives Kelly, Moran, and Gauthier. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Mariani, I think, brought up a great point, and I think by the answer, we really haven't thought about the arbitrary arrest. And I'm just curious, not that I don't want this on the list, but maybe this is a research question, is there penalties or legislatively or not legislatively, but criminal penalties for arbitrary arrest? Is that something that that if it was proven that was the cause to detain a representative? I have no idea, but I think you asked the question, and I think by the answer, we really haven't thought about that, so I was just curious on it.
Mr. Chair and members, there's certainly a civil cause of action for a false arrest, but I'm not aware of what the criminal penalties are for, if there are any, for abuse of the power of arrest.
Mr. Chair, I just thought it was a great observation. It doesn't sound like we really have thought that piece out, so I'm done.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was sitting here and saying, gosh, I really agree with Representative Grunhagen. I'm like, wow. But I do, and I think that as we sit here and we create laws that says drinking and driving is, there's a penalty for doing that, and it has consequences to that that we as elected bodies need to also abide by that. But I get so excited each and every time I see young people who are engaged in this political process and bringing your voice to this building. It's really, really good to see that happen, because it's important. And so I just want to thank Representative Kreisel for electing to author this and bring that and bring this forth. And say I definitely support this. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Boozing and cruising, I kind of like that terminology. Thank you for bringing this forward. I plan on voting for it. I guess my, and thank you for exercising your rights as citizens. And Concordia seems to have a long history of bringing forth some things. So I guess I would challenge you to look at some of our very serious social issues that we have in this state with poverty and health care and the list goes on and on and on, because I believe you'll probably be back. You know, we depend on a lot of people. We depend on research staff. We depend on our own staff. We depend on citizens bringing us information. So I would just challenge you to take a look at those things. I mean, we're going to have a great debate in this state very shortly called an election on the direction of the state of Minnesota. And there's a ton of issues that I would encourage you to take a look at some of them and come back to us.
Okay, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Representative Salt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think probably this is a question for Mr. Diebel, but it just occurs to me to ask, what is the penalty for breach of peace in other contexts?
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, the term actually isn't defined as not an offense in and of itself. There are, for example, in Section 609.705, unlawful assembly. It's a pretty short statute, but it's, and I'll just read it for complete clarity. When three or more persons assemble, each participant is guilty of unlawful assembly, which is a misdemeanor, if the assembly is with intent to carry out any purpose in such manner as will disturb or threaten the public peace, or without unlawful purpose, but the participants so conduct themselves in a disorderly manner as to disturb or threaten the public peace. And I've looked at this when drafting the legislation, and you have to go to case law to find what constitutes a breach of peace. It's not defined in statute. And so this would be adding this term, or DWI, statutorily to what is an otherwise case law defined term of breach of peace.
I'll have to think about that for a minute, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions from members?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Marion.
So just a quick, thank you, just a quick observation and partly response to Representative Kelly's kind of thinking through this with me as well. I guess, I'd forgotten that, in fact, we do have a list of particularly in the areas of felony that would, in fact, could lead to the detention, of a member from participating. So we've already carved down that road, and I wasn't thinking about that earlier. And it would seem to me, Representative Kelly, that if there have been issues, I mean, this isn't the strongest argument, but I think it's important for us just to think through this. If there have been issues relative to arbitrary, detentions and arrests, we probably would have seen those by now. So that provides me a little bit of comfort in terms of adding, another area here. But I do think it's important for us to, as the legislative branch, to consistently be vigilant. About, because we are talking about, whether it's your local, law enforcement or, state level, we are talking about the executive branch, exercising some control over the freedoms and privileges of the legislative branch. And so I think part of my question to the students had to do with, give me your best guess about what are you thinking about society that we would never go down that road. And so I would still urge you to think through that, carefully. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that I think we're okay. I don't think we've seen abuse of power in the state of Minnesota, and that's probably a good reflection on our culture.
our psychology as people relative to these privileges, but it's important for us to always be vigilant about this issue.
Representative Gilby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having ruminated for a few moments here, it seems to me that maybe what we ought to think about doing is putting some kind of an actual definition of breach of peace in the statutes, because if we're concerned about people being detained unreasonably, or if we're other than legitimate purposes, it seems to me if we don't know what breach of the peace is, it would be pretty easy to charge somebody with it.
And that might be something that the students want to take up next year, a definition of breach of the peace. All right. Members, any more questions? Representative Mulery, did you have a question?
I'll just let it go.
Okay. If not, would any of the students like to say anything, or Representative Kreisel in closing?
Just thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for giving this bill a hearing. I want to thank the students for bringing it forward and getting involved in the process. You have a future, and if you want to move to Cottage Grove, there's an open seat now, I've heard. So, again, thank you very much. I would urge your support on this bill, and I'd appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kreisel, you would like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1838 pass and be sent to the General Register.
Okay, folks have heard the motion. Any questions? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Congratulations, students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Representative Slocum, would you like to move a Representative Champion's bill? And it's going away.
Jump back to the General Register.
This Representative Slocum, House File 718, be recommended to pass and back to the General Register. And Representative Champion, if you would explain kind of the history of this. This has already passed once, correct? It sat on the floor, and we're bringing it back for repassage. And then you also have an amendment, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to offer that amendment? Or Representative Slocum, would you like to offer the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the A2 amendment to House File 718.
If I might just explain the...
Why don't we just go ahead and add it, and then you can explain it.
Okay.
That's what we usually do. We get it in the shape the author wants it. Representative Slocum offers to the A2 amendment to House File 718. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Champion.
And, Mr. Chair, I would like to have David Chris from the Department of Corrections to just talk about the importance of this amendment.
Chris, good to see you again. Go ahead and state your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is David Christ. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. We made the friendly suggestion to the author and to the committee regarding this amendment. During the last round of sovereign tribal elections, we were asked by the tribes to allow absentee ballots to come into registered tribal members to vote in the tribal elections. The addition of the words here, issued under Chapter 203B, refers to absentee ballots governed under Minnesota statutes for Minnesota elections and to federal elections, and we think allows the sovereign tribes to let their members vote in their own elections. I just don't want the Department of Corrections to get caught in between state statute and the sovereign laws if we were to say to Native American offenders, you can't vote in your sovereign elections. I'll note also, Mr. Chair, that language to this effect is already included in the bill that Representative Benson has had before this committee, and we just wanted to add it to Representative Champion's bill if possible.
Okay, members, any questions for Mr. Crist? Representative Champion, you want to just kind of give a general walk through the bill, not item by item, but just what it does, again, for our edification?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarity, first of all, this bill is not. This bill does not change any of the rights a felon has who's still on probation. It doesn't change any of that. It doesn't change, it does not suggest that someone who's incarcerated has a right to vote. It doesn't change that. We know that a person who's incarcerated or on probation cannot vote. What this bill simply does is addresses an issue that we've talked about, which is wanting to make sure that people who are still on probation do not inadvertently go into the polls and vote when they're not supposed to. That's all this bill seeks to address. To address. First of all, if you look, and I probably should have started on the back, so if you look on page 2, section 4, starting at 3.2, excuse me, page 3, 3.22, what it does is on the front end, if someone pleads guilty to or adjudicated guilty of a felony level offense, all I'm saying is that the court or the judge, when the judge says you cannot possess a firearm, I just want the judge to also say, and you cannot vote until you're off probation, right? And then if you look at subdivision 3, which it talks about the form of notice, this also says it once a person, you know, if they, you know, are incarcerated or not, or once they're off probation, I just want the probation officer, when they're discharging the person, to say, hey, you no longer have to come see me, you're off probation, and now your civil rights are restored where you can vote, so you have to, you know, go through the proper process in order to get registered. Section 3 simply addresses an issue where it's possible, and most people don't know this, but you could possibly go execute all your time in prison. You can say, you know what, I don't want to be on probation. I don't want to do any of that. I want to execute all my time in prison. And they can go spend their time in prison, and once they walk out of prison, they're not on probation or anything. They're done, right? And so this just suggests that a correctional facilities will have a person there, so just like a discharge from probation, they're leaving out the door saying, hey, you have the right to vote, so you have to go register with the Secretary of State's office. And so that just, again, clarifies when a person can or cannot vote. And then if you look at Section 2, this was an amendment that I put onto the bill by way of a request from Representative Quam, because what he was concerned about was absentee ballots being sought after by inmates. You know, he says, well, what if a person, you know, requests an absentee ballot and they have an address of a correctional facilities that's that house only felons? You know, we want to prevent that from happening, so we just put that in the bill to really make sure that those absentee ballots cannot just go to individuals. And that's where that carve out that you just heard Mr. Crist talk about. And finally, Section 1 just says that the Secretary of State's office shall develop accurate and complete information in a single publication about voting rights of people who've been charged with or convicted of a felony level offense. And the driver for that is when I was out talking to a number of different people during elections, people think that if they have ever committed a felony and they're off paper that they can't vote again. They just feel like, hey, you know, I'm a felon, so I can't ever vote again. And so I spent lots of time correcting them, because under Minnesota Statute 609, they can vote. As soon as their probation is up, their rights are automatically restored. The only right that is not automatically restored is a person's ability to carry or hold a firearm or possess a firearm. And so that's the bill. This is the bill that this committee has already voted on. There's nothing different about it. It was on the floor. And you know, at the end of last year, it comes back to the last committee that it was in front of. So that is why we're here.
Okay, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Champion, I'm very supportive of your bill. And as you know, Representative Benson has an election law bill going forward. And one of my concerns is about notification of restoration of rights. And under that bill, there's time delays, where a person could conceivably get off of probation and that notification to the Secretary of State wouldn't arrive in time for the election. So they wouldn't get the proper notification. And so what I'd like you to consider is the people who know when somebody's getting off probation work for the Department of Corrections, parole officers, probation officers, so on and so forth, that DOC make a written notification that a person's civil rights and voting rights have been restored. So we don't deny people the right to vote just because of time lags in the Benson bill that says DOC has to inform the Secretary of State 60 days before the election, blah, blah, blah. And 60 days, a lot of people could be off probation and able to vote and not know that. So it's just a concern I have, and maybe we can work on that or hopefully address that issue.
Representative Jeff?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, Representative Gautier. That is something we can definitely work on. I was hoping to address that by looking at Section 3. That's why immediately if a person was leaving a correctional facility that they would receive that notice right then. It wouldn't be mailed to them, but they would get that information right then. And secondly, I believe that I was trying to address that in Section 3, but Subdivision 3, whereas once they are discharged, that information goes immediately to them, because under the law, under 609.165, as soon as they're off probation, their rights are automatically restored. So even if they don't get the information, and we want them to have the information, it doesn't negate their right to vote.
Okay, Representative Mullery?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I understand that, Representative Champion, and my concern comes from the Benson bill requiring written notification and that people will be flagged at the polls as a possible person who doesn't have the right to vote, so that we have some kind of official documentation from DOC that says, yes, your rights have been restored.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I definitely would check into that because I think that would be problematic.
Representative Mullery.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to comment on a changeover by the administrative agencies. I started working on this about 8 years ago, and then when Mr. Ritchie became Secretary of State, he also was working on it, and we just kind of got a runaround from the administrative departments, and also the probation officers at that time blocked it, but they've come around and seen they've been enlightened, let's just say, in the last couple of years, and I want to thank them for at least being open enough to reconsider their mistakes of the past, and I think this is an absolutely must-needed law that we need.
Okay. Any questions on the bill from any members? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, is there and I don't think you addressed this, was there a fiscal note associated with this the first time around? Is it the same one?
Mr. Chair, let's see. The last fiscal note I had on this bill, there was a zero fiscal note.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say to Representative Champion.
Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say to Representative Champion, thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's a good bill, and I think what we all want to do is to ensure that people who could vote, who can vote, are voting, and those who cannot and should not be voting are not voting. And I think this helps that process.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Representative.
Okay, Representative Slocum, would you like to renew the motion for Representative Champion's bill?
Thank you. I renew the motion that House File 718 be passed and as amended and go to the General Register.
Okay, folks have heard the motion. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next meeting is Tuesday at 10:15.
All right. See you then.